Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. This evening marks our 17th annual William E. Simon Lecture by George Weigel, Distinguished Senior Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. We are deeply grateful to the William E. Simon Foundation for its generous and steadfast support, both of this lecture series and of George's William E. Simon Chair in Catholic Studies. 29 years into his tenure at EPPC, George remains as remarkably prolific and influential as ever. Last fall, he completed his magisterial triptych portrait of St. John Paul the Great with Lessons in Hope, My Unexpected Life with St. John Paul II. Chinese editions of Witness to Hope and The End and the Beginning, the first two parts of that triptych, should be completed very soon. That will bring to 14 the number of foreign language editions of Witness to Hope, including a pirated translation ordered by the Politburo of the Vietnamese Communist Party. No royalties on that one. George's newest book, The Fragility of Order, Catholic Reflections in Turbulent Times, will be released in early April, but we have advanced copies available for you this evening. On top of his books, George continues to publish the most widely circulated Catholic press column in the country, reaching a combined readership of more than 2 million persons each week. Longer articles of his appear regularly in a wide variety of domestic and foreign publications. He delivers dozens of speeches around the country and around the world every year, and he shares his expertise by consulting with church leaders and policymakers. George and his Catholic Studies program provide the model that my other EPPC colleagues and I emulate. We work to articulate the principles of our Judeo-Christian moral tradition and to apply those principles to the great challenges of the day. We take the long view as we work to rebuild a culture that will sustain the great American experiment in Republican self-government long after we have shuffled off this mortal coil. Our own encounters with mortality have, alas, been much too keen this past year. In August, Mike Cromarty, who had been at the heart of EPPC for more than three decades, passed away. Just 2 months ago in January, we lost Senior Fellow Bruce Cole, the distinguished art historian, cultural critic, and longtime head of the National Endowment for the Humanities. And we have mourned the deaths of numerous dear friends of EPPC, including Michael Novak, Father Arnie Panula, Peter Berger, Don Briel, and Jeffrey Bell. Tonight, we pay tribute in a special way to one of those dear departed friends, the extraordinary and unforgettable Kate O'Byrne, whose celebratory remarks highlighted our 40th anniversary gala just 2 years ago. Kate had a remarkable public career in which she excelled in one role after another. Washington editor of National Review, regular panelist on the Capitol Gang, New York Times best-selling author, think tank leader, and president of National Review Institute, to name just some of them. As anyone who ever met her can attest, Kate was also delightful, engaging, hilariously funny, and down to earth. And she was deeply dedicated to her family and friends, a loving wife, mother, grandmother, and sister. Kate's deep Catholic faith infused her life and informed her work. So I'm especially delighted to announce the establishment in George's Catholic Studies program of our new Kate O'Byrne Fellowship in Catholic Studies. We're honored to have with us this evening Kate's husband, Jim. Her son, Phil, is John here now? I'm sorry, I missed John. He's coming. Her sisters, Virginia, Marianne, and Rosemary. Her granddaughter, Charlotte. And many other family members and friends. I'm also pleased to report the birth last fall, in November, of Phil and Kathleen's youngest, who has been graced with the name of Kate O'Byrne. I'm equally delighted to announce that Mary Hassan will be our Kate O'Byrne Fellow. Mary is a powerful and clear voice on issues of life, gender, marriage, family, and sexuality. She's also built our Catholic Women's Forum, an outstanding network of Catholic women scholars and leaders. I can do no better than to quote Jim O'Byrne's beautiful words about Mary. Mary Hassan is a wonderful pick to be EPPC's Kate O'Byrne Fellow, as she exemplifies in virtue, intelligence, wisdom, and spirit the type of woman in full that Kate sought to be herself, The fact that the two were dear friends down the years is a beautiful icing on the cake. Thank you, Jim, and congratulations, Mary. Our thanks to the generous admirers of Kate and Mary who made this fellowship possible. Thank you also to my colleagues who've organized this event, Steve White, Sylvia Travoloni, Josh Britton, Mark Shanuti, Sarah Shanuti, and Natalie Robertson. You are all welcome to the reception and book signings that will take place immediately after the lecture, directly across the hall. And now, without further ado, please welcome George Weigel to address Democracy and Its Discontents.
Thank you, Ed, and good evening, everyone. In October 1990, Charles Krauthammer and I were having lunch, pastrami and corned beef, as I recall, and the conversation naturally turned on the dramatic events of the past year. The captive nations of Central and Eastern Europe had liberated themselves from the Soviet external empire in a political revolution energized by the revolution of conscience that swept the region in the 1980s. In the evil empire itself, the first flowers of democratic resistance were springing up from beneath the frozen carapace of the Leninist system in the Baltic states and Ukraine. Deng Xiaoping's market-centered authoritarianism in China had been challenged in massive public demonstrations featuring a Chinese version of the Statue of Liberty. The democratic transitions of the 1980s in Latin America and East Asia seemed to be prospering. None of this could have been predicted in that talismanic year, 1984, so as Charles and I were reveling in what seemed to be history's vindication of our democratic and anti-communist convictions, he asked me, half whimsically, what are we going to do with the rest of our lives? The great struggle of our generation, the war between imperfect democracies and pluperfect tyrannies, seemed to have been won by the champions of freedom. Although I replied that history wasn't over and there would be plenty for each of us to do, I couldn't have imagined that within two decades, the democratic project would be under assault throughout the world, and not only by adversarial regimes like Vladimir Putin's authoritarian kleptocracy in Russia or Xi Jinping's increasingly repressive and aggressive China, but under assault from within. Yet that is the situation that confronts us today. In East Central Europe, the notion of illiberal democracy, a regime in which one party claiming a monopoly on national identity and tradition maintains itself permanently in power, has become part of the political landscape. There, too, one finds open talk of the Salazar model, a relatively benign authoritarianism that uses state power to manage politics, the economy, and the culture in order to insulate the people from the riptides of postmodernity. Here in the United States, intellectually serious voices assert that ours is an ill-founded republic whose present discontents and dysfunctions are the predictable working out of fatal flaws in the intellectual and moral cultural foundations of American democracy. All over the world, young people, meaning millennials born since 1980, seem suspicious of democracy and willing to flirt with efficient authoritarianism. The World Values Survey reports that only 30% of American millennials and 43% of Euro millennials think it essential to live in a country that is governed democratically, while about 35% of millennials globally think it would be good or very good to have in their countries a strong leader who doesn't have to, quote, bother with parliaments and elections. These attitudes are not confined to millennials, however. Surveys indicate that one-third of all Americans would favor the authoritarian rule of a leader unconstrained by the checks and balances of our constitutional system, and one in six would like that strongman to wear a military uniform. Similar figures are reported in Germany, and some surveys suggest that half the population of both Great Britain and France would welcome some version of Caldeo rule. History is clearly not over, and the prospect of the political history of the West taking some nasty turns cannot be precluded. Sorting out this season of democratic disorientation and charting the path of democratic renewal requires a sober assessment of democracy's present discontents and a refresher course in some basic truths about the nature of the democratic project and the conditions for its flourishing. Those are both vast subjects, so what follows tonight are some program notes for beginning an analytic and prescriptive conversation about the 21st century democratic project. The most visible and politically consequential critics of the contemporary democratic project here and in Europe are typically labeled populists. It's not a term I find very useful. For how do you find insight, much less precision, in an ideological moniker used to describe both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump? What light is shed on a grassroots political phenomenon when both an elite journal of culture, the New Criterion, and a race to the bottom website like Breitbart News describe it as populist? What does it mean to call populist a smorgasbord that includes statist, ethno-nationalist, and libertarian proposals? So rather than treat the new populism as a coherent ideology and program, I propose we think about it by analogy to medical science. Just as a fever in the human body is a signal that something is wrong in that body, so the varied and sometimes contradictory populist fevers and passions in the transatlantic body politic are signals that the democratic project, far from being perfected in the post-Cold War world, has in fact got some serious problems. Or as historian George Nash puts it, populism gives a voice to the hitherto voiceless who often have legitimate grievances that deserve redress. What are those grievances? What are these populists upset about? The most prominent among populist grievances would seem to include the following. First, the economic dislocations caused by globalization and the failure of a globalized economy to lift all boats, a grievance first analyzed by Charles Murray's Coming Apart and then poignantly described in J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy, and one that is more prominent in the United States than Europe, where womb-to-tomb social welfare systems tend to protect the less skilled from the churnings of rapid economic change. Second, widespread fears in Europe of the loss of national sovereignty to distant, unaccountable, and often overbearing transnational bureaucracies, a grievance that is mirrored in the United States in the concerns of Tea Party and other activists about the erosion of state and local authority because of the vast reach of the national government into virtually every aspect of our common life. Third, the skepticism, mockery, scorn, and disdain that is regularly poured over traditional cultural institutions and mores by elites in the arts, the universities, the mainstream media, and the entertainment industry. A form of cultural authoritarianism that not infrequently motivates and sustains the heavy hand of coercive state power in enforcing what elites consider enlightened social arrangements essential to the democratic future, but which many populists regard as policies that erode community cohesion and threaten basic civil rights, such as religious freedom. Fourth, the intuition, ominously similar to what was afoot in certain European circles in the 1920s and 1930s, that democracy is simply incapable of coping with the vast forces of change unleashed by modernity and postmodernity, forces that are, on this view, best harnessed and channeled by authoritarianisms of one sort or another. Here, aggravations with the dysfunction of democratic institutions and democratic politics can too easily bleed over into deep skepticism about, even contempt for, the democratic project itself. Fifth, the cult of license, which despite its promises of liberation, does not seem to have added to the sum total of human happiness. A distinguished group of European intellectuals recently connected the dots between this misunderstanding of freedom and the disaffection of some of the young from the democratic project. They wrote, "For Europe's younger generation, reality is not gilt with gold. Libertine hedonism often leads to boredom and a profound sense of purposelessness. In the roiling sea of sexual liberty, the deep desires of our young people to marry and form families are often frustrated. A liberty that frustrates our heart's deepest longings becomes a curse." Yet despite that unhappiness, the cultural tsunami of a freedom without measure continues to blast its way across the democratic landscape, leading to severe cultural disorientation and anger among many. Finally, it should be recognized that it is not just left-dominated elite institutions that have provoked contempt from many people. Populist wrath, especially in the United States, is also directed toward what might be called the conservative establishment. As frustration and dissatisfaction have grown, so has distrust of the intellectual and political leadership that, fairly or unfairly, is deemed responsible for the foreign policy failures of the George W. Bush administration, the dislocations and worse of the Great Recession, and the inability to forestall two Obama administrations. That this distrust was the driving force behind the rise of Donald Trump in the Republican Party seems obvious, whether one finds the vessel of that discontent worthy or not. These seem to me some of the principal grievances motivating those labeled populists. No doubt there are others, and no doubt some of those other grievances reflect ignoble attitudes and corrosive ideas that are incompatible with the dignity of the human person and thus with the democratic project. Yet it would be a serious mistake to regard the grievances noted here as ignoble or base or irrational. They are not. And to regard them as such is, in a word, undemocratic, for in the sphere of culture, they are often expressions of people's most deeply held and felt religious and moral convictions. If those convictions are ruled out of play in the democratic public square, then democracy really is in trouble. What happens when these grievances interact with those forces in our politics that have been accustomed to defining the boundaries of the argument over public policy? Well, we see what has been called tribal epistemology, which exists at many points along the political spectrum, and especially at its hardened edges, an epistemic clannishness that makes it impossible to imagine that someone with a different policy prescription might be honest, well-intentioned, and just maybe even right. Daniel Henninger of the Wall Street Journal has another useful label for this, the politics of them, and it is most certainly not confined to the far right or to Trump voters or in the European context to Brexiteers, supporters of Poland's Law and Justice Party, or followers of France's Marine Le Pen. In fact, a good argument can be made that epistemological tribalism in its current form began on the left under the influence of Herbert Marcuse, whose disdain for repressive tolerance, as he called it, has reemerged from the fever swamps of the 60s and is now making a mockery of free speech and elementary civility on too many American campuses. But whatever its contemporary genealogy, epistemic tribalism and the incapacity to see anything of value in what the other thinks or believes is now pandemic across the political landscape of the West. And that tribalism makes the robust encounter of competing ideas, which is essential to the democratic project, very difficult. Another thing we see is a public space dominated by the loudest, most hysterical voices. The Facebook and Twitter demagogues who practice the political neo-Darwinism that George F. Will describes as the survival of the shrillest. This phenomenon is not limited to the woolier parts of the blogosphere. At all points along the conventional political spectrum, and even among people who rightly think themselves serious thinkers, the tendency today is to jump straight to DEFCON 1 and let fly with rhetorical nuclear weapons at the first sign of disagreement. Fevered public exchange then leads in turn to debased public standards of debate. Or as my colleague James Bowman puts it, decency itself has become partisan, and so is no longer decency in any traditional sense of the word. The result, as Jim Bowman noted, is that it's now, quote, taken for granted that politics is war and the enemy is other, not subject to reasoned argument, but only an object for hatred and contempt. In this echo chamber of epithets, the reductio ad Hitlerum tends to be the default position of those most concerned about populism, and the reductio ad diabolum is the default countermove among the aggrieved. Two more signals that the democratic project is in distress. For there can be no democracy without the exercise of reason, and there can be no democracy without that minimum of civility that declines the tiara of infallibility and is willing to acknowledge that the other just might have a point. So, it is imperative that those who would be part of a broad-based movement of democratic renewal in the West acknowledge that these discontents, sometimes dismissed as populism of a deranged or immoral sort, are neither unreal nor imaginary. Rather, they signal distempers and even diseases in the body politic. Recognizing that is the first order of business. But as the great Peggy Lee might have put it, the discontents are not all there is. And to several of these discontents and grievances, a cautionary but should be added to fill out a realistic portrait of the situation. Yes, there have been serious dislocations in America because of the globalization of the economy. And yes, too little has been done by both the private and public sectors to address that by empowering the dislocated to become productive, participatory members of the American economic and political communities. But that recognition should be completed by a parallel recognition of the pathology that J.D. Vance has called learned helplessness, a pathology, I might add, that America's churches have done precious little to address, and that is one root of today's epidemic of opioid abuse. It is also true in the European case that the European Union bureaucracy is often overbearing, impervious to criticism, dismissive of traditional national mores, and hostile to religious conviction in public life. But it is also true that EU funds have rebuilt much of the infrastructure of the new democracies of Central and Eastern Europe, as EU funds have helped recover and restore much of the cultural patrimony in architecture and art that was severely damaged by 6 years of war and 45 years of communist neglect and worse. Moreover, transnational institutions like NATO and the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe have preserved the peace after a century in which Europe was twice on the verge of destroying itself and taking much of the world with it had the second round had a different outcome. So transnational does not always equal bad. Yet, in both the United States and Europe, courts have usurped many of the functions once performed by democratically elected and thus democratically accountable legislatures. And yes, this usurpation is a serious threat to democracy. But it is also true in the United States that the federal judiciary got into this position because of legislative failures at the national, state, and local levels to address the injustice of legally enforced racial discrimination. Moreover, the most vital body of thought, of legal thought, in the late 20th and early 21st centuries has mounted an impressive challenge to judicial authoritarianism, and that challenge is now being worked out in practice in the American federal judiciary. As for Europe, a more complete portrait of the legal landscape would acknowledge that transnational legal institutions have been useful and important in bringing to account genocidal warlords from the breakup of what was once Yugoslavia. And it may be hoped that the grievances being pressed, however clumsily, by various East Central European countries, as well as the fallout from Brexit, may compel some serious rethinking about the relationship between EU law and national legal systems. Thus, in surveying the complex, disturbed democratic landscape of the West today, it will be helpful to keep in mind the example of Winston Churchill. Shortly after Nazi Germany unconditionally surrendered, and with the defeat of Japan assured, the British people, as Churchill wrote, immediately dismissed me from all further conduct of their affairs in the 1945 parliamentary election. Offered the Order of the Garter on his way out of 10 Downing Street, Churchill replied, "Why should I accept the Order of the Garter when the British people have just given me the Order of the Boot?" Yet after this stinging blow, and as leader of the opposition in the House of Commons, Churchill could still say in a parliamentary debate on November 11, 1947, democracy is the worst form of government except for all those other forms that have been tried from time to time. Democratic renewal in this season of democratic discontent will also require reclaiming some basic truths about the democratic project. 5 such basic truths must be reworked into the texture of our public life. The first of those truths is that, human folly excepted, nothing in history is permanent, including democracy. Democracy is not ordained by history as its final and inevitable end. Democracy is by its nature an experiment. An experiment in a people's capacity for self-government. Democracies can fail, as the example of the Weimar Republic in interwar Germany should remind us. Weimar Germany had a beautifully constructed democratic system designed in the aftermath of World War I by some very able people, including the great social scientist Max Weber. Yet the system proved incapable of absorbing the shocks of the Great Depression because the cultural foundations of the system were insecure. And the net result was that Weimar democratically produced its own demise with lethal results on a continental and unprecedented scale. By the same token, it ought to be remembered that democracies are quite capable of self-renewal. The classic period of the American Civil Rights Movement is a reminder within living memory that robust moral conviction can successfully challenge both entrenched attitudes and prejudices and renew a democracy's legal system. More recently, the Democratic Revolution of 1989 in Central and Eastern Europe displaced a great tyranny by the power of moral conviction wedded to national tradition, courage, and shrewd politics. Still, it is imperative that democratic renewal in the 21st century begin with a recognition of the basic truth that there is nothing inevitable about democracy, that democracy must not only be affirmed, but earned by every generation. The second truth to be reclaimed is the truth that democracy is not a machine that can run by itself. Or, if you prefer a post-industrial analogy, democracy is not a hardware that can be run by any software. What we mean by the democratic project in the 21st century is, in fact, a complex system composed of three interlocking parts. Those of you who drank cheap beer in the Middle Atlantic states during your college days might want to think of the old Ballantine three-ring logo. One part of the system is a democratic polity in which the people govern themselves through representatives regularly elected. The judiciary is independent of the legislature and the executive, and civil liberties, which define large spheres of life where the state cannot intrude, and which buttress the non-state space known as civil society, are defined in law. Another part of the system is a market-based economy, which is regulated by law and custom, but in which the state is not the chief economic actor. And the third part of the system, the one that is most often ignored, although it is the key to the proper functioning of a free polity and a free economy, is a vibrant public moral culture. The vitality of the public moral culture is crucial to the democratic project because it takes a certain kind of people living certain virtues to make free politics and free economics work so that the net result is genuine human flourishing. The machinery of democracy and the market cannot produce that flourishing on their own or by themselves. That is the hard lesson of Weimar, and it needs to be pondered by both political scientists of a functionalist cast of mind and economic libertarians today. In the three interlocking systems of the contemporary democratic project, the moral cultural system's vitality is nurtured primarily by the institutions of civil society. Those institutions include both natural associations like the family and voluntary associations such as religious communities, business and labor associations, and civil organizations of various sorts. Among the free institutions of civil society, the family is of immense importance because stable families are the first schools of freedom, rightly understood as freedom for excellence, freedom for nobility, and freedom for solidarity. As Mary Eberstadt has pointed out in a series of brilliant articles, the deconstruction of the family by the sexual revolution is closely related to many phenomena that now threaten the democratic project, from crime and substance abuse to aggressive forms of identity politics that seek to shut down public debate. Thus, democratic renewal will look carefully to the revitalization of civil society and the family. The third truth to be reclaimed, or perhaps in this case asserted for the first time since the 60s, is that liberal democratic politics and free or liberal economics cannot be sustained by a liberal culture. If by liberal culture one means a culture of expressive individualism and exclusivist secularism, a culture built on the notions that there are no deep truths inscribed in the human person, that there is at best your truth and my truth, and that the good is what an individual wills or wants. Such a truth-starved and morally anorexic culture is incapable of sustaining free politics and free economics because it cannot answer the questions, why be civil and tolerant, and why accept the electoral choice of the majority? Nor can the culture of me sustain free economies, because it cannot explain why productive efficiency and shareholder satisfaction are not sufficient measures of a free economy that is free in a truly human sense. And at the bottom of the bottom line, the culture of me is incapable of defending the claim that the democratic project, for all its discontents and flaws, is nonetheless morally superior to the various authoritarianisms on offer in the 21st century, because it is itself committed, that culture of me, to the authoritarianism of the imperial autonomous self. Successful democracies require statesmanship and civic virtue, George Nash reminds us. And there will be little statesmanship of the sort needed in many Western democracies today without a new flourishing of the virtues. For statesmen are made, not born, and statesmanship is not a matter of genetic inheritance, but of learning from a culture of virtue and its truths, and living the experience of a culture of virtue with all its disciplines. This truth has gotten lost in the West since the 60s, that decade of unbridled self-absorption in the playpen of expressive individualism. For a while, it seemed as if the effects of that moral cultural deconstruction were largely confined to Western Europe, where 1968 marked not just a bad year, as here in America, but a cultural rupture that overtly and comprehensively rejected the past and sought to expunge traditional mores and commitments from public life. But it should now be clear that expressive individualism has had a devastating effect on the United States as well, to the point where we are now instructed by the high culture and may soon be compelled by the law to believe, or at least act as if we believed, that such givens of the human condition as maleness and femaleness are in fact choices or cultural constructs to be altered at will. So, democratic renewal in the 21st century will require a serious rebuilding of the culture of what used to be called republican virtue, in which the claims of individual rights are once again linked to responsibilities, and the promotion of the common good is once again understood to be everyone's civic responsibility. And in this process of rebuilding, there will have to be serious discussion about the limits and boundaries of pluralism. For in the marriage debate and the now raging debate over a variety of LGBTQ issues, it has become clear, or ought to have become clear, that a pluralism without boundaries is in fact a prescription for the use of coercive state power to enforce expressive individualism and moral relativism on all of society, even if doing so means threatening nuns with massive and crippling fines because of their allegedly retrograde convictions. The fourth truth to be reclaimed involves the free economy. There's a curious symmetry to be pondered here. Both the Bolsheviks and Friedrich Hayek recognize that markets are essential to the democratic project, which is why the Bolsheviks sought to eliminate markets and why Hayek defended economic freedom. For as Helen Andrews recently put it, Hayek recognized that the decision to fix prices or plan production does not lead to an unaccountable army of paid snoops and arbitrary bureaucrats. It necessarily implies them, because those are the only possible means of its enforcement. And of course, things got far worse than that. In the Soviet case, as Ann Applebaum has shown, the Gulag system of slave labor camps for political prisoners was an essential, not aberrant, component of that 20th century alternative to the democratic project. The question for democratic renewal, then, is not yay or nay to markets or capitalism. The question is how temper and direct markets so that the vast energies let loose by economic freedom contribute to rebuilding the foundations of civic life rather than eroding those foundations through that form of self-absorption called consumerism, in which human worth is measured by what a person has rather than who a person is. This is obviously a task for both the political and moral cultural systems, the former through law and regulation, the latter through the formation of character. There will be, or should be, ample room within the project of democratic renewal for debating how large a role law and regulation should play in the free economy. But those committed to democratic renewal can no longer avoid the hard questions about the relationship of the political and moral cultural systems to the free economy on the question of setting boundaries to public moral life. In 1971, when Playboy and Penthouse defined the outer limits of the publicly acceptable, the late, great Irving Kristol wrote that the modern American settlement of this ancient question, a settlement, as he put it, in which obscenity and democracy are regarded as equals, is wrong. It is inherently unstable, and it will, in the long run, be incompatible with any authentic concern for the quality of life in our democracy. That long run is now here. And the question of whether the equation of unbridled public access to materials that appeal to what Kristol described as the more irrational and infantile parts of human desire is so eroding republican virtue as to erode the democratic project itself. There are obviously no easy answers here, but unless the question of the compatibility or incompatibility of unbridled libido and democratic self-governance is on the table, the project of democratic renewal will stall and may fail. The fifth truth to be reclaimed in the project of democratic renewal is the truth that serious criticism must be responsible criticism. There is something disturbingly insouciant about the potshots taken at the Democratic Project today by partisans who cannot concede that they ran a flawed candidate and an inept campaign in 2016, or by intellectuals who have never confronted the hard tasks of consensus building and governance, or by millennials who romanticize pre-modern politics, or by all those who indulge in an adolescent style of opposition in which the responsibility to suggest plausible alternatives is routinely ignored. Irresponsible or insouciant criticism gets us nowhere. Democracy and the market may self-destruct, as I said earlier. Nothing is permanent in history. But for the moment, for those who cherish the dignity of the human person, the possibility of participation in public life, the rule of law, the adventure of entrepreneurial inventiveness, and the noble task of deliberating in common the best means to achieve goods imperfectly known and never fully achieved, the democratic project, understood as the tripartite system of a democratic polity, a market-centered economy, and a vibrant public moral culture, is the only serious option. Salazar 2.0 is not an option for those who cherish those goods. Neither is Xi Jinping authoritarianism Occidental style. Neither is a return to benign monarchy. So the task ahead is one of healing and reforming the democratic project in its three component parts, a task which is not advanced by indulging in fantasies about implausible or impossible alternatives. Those who wish to take up that task and who recognize that multiculturalism and transnationalism cannot inspire the loyalties that make democratic solidarity possible must foster the development of an alternative to ethno-nationalism and xenophobia. That alternative is civic patriotism enlivened by republican virtue. In European context, that civic patriotism will involve an embrace of what has long been understood to be home, culturally and linguistically, but now which now seems threatened by a bland yet smothering multiculturalism and an aggressive transnationalism that seems deaf and blind to legitimate concerns about national cultural integrity. That embrace of home must be open rather than crabbed, and it ought not be confused with strident forms of ethno-nationalism that deny to those who are religiously or racially other any possibility of finding home where the majority religious or ethnic or racial group has long found it. On the other hand, partisans of the utility of the European Union and its satellite and parallel institutions must recognize that national identities forged by centuries of experience have real value, and that the nation state remains, for the overwhelming majority of people in the West, the basic unit of political identity. In America, the development of civic patriotism will take a somewhat different path given the native plurality of our population. Here, civic patriotism will reflect a renewed commitment to those truths on which the founders staked their lives, fortunes, and sacred honor, which means that America must once again affirm that there are self-evident truths that can be known by reason, that knowing these truths teaches us both our obligations and the limits of the legitimate role of the state in our lives, and that affirming those truths is what makes us American, irrespective of anyone's grandparents' country of origin. Radical skepticism about the human capacity to know anything with certainty, and the moral relativism that is skepticism's inevitable byproduct, are incompatible with a renewal of republican virtue and with the development of a vibrant civic patriotism. Nor can skepticism and relativism provide effective cultural barriers against the 21st century drift by democracies old and new into one or another form of authoritarianism, the authoritarianism of illiberal democracy and the authoritarianism characterized by the heavy use of state power to impose the culture of me on all of society. Whether that cultural renewal is possible in Europe is, frankly, an open question, given the collapse of Europe's traditional religious communities, the triumph of postmodern nihilism, skepticism, and relativism in Europe's universities, and the European demographic crisis caused by self-induced infertility. There is more reason to be hopeful about the United States, for history teaches us that American democracy is remarkably resilient, thanks in large part to the vitality of American civil society. But hopes for a renewal of republican virtue and a flourishing of civic patriotism are going to be dashed if religious leaders in America continue to trade their moral authority for the mess of pottage that is proximity to political power, or if men and women who have devoted their lives to cultural excellence continue to make excuses for vulgarity and crudity at the highest levels of government, or if liberty continues to be confused with license across the entire bandwidth of the political spectrum. Which is to say that both conservatives and progressives in these United States need a thorough examination of conscience about their respective responsibilities for our current democratic discontents, which are no longer just a matter of frustration with Washington political dysfunction. The most urgent challenge at this moment of democratic discontent, then, is the challenge to rebuild a democratic culture marked by respect for basic human rights, a clear understanding that those rights are not mere expressions of personal willfulness, a commitment to live freedom in service to the common good, and a renewal of that solidarity that Jacques Maritain called civic friendship, the friendship of citizens united by a common purpose. The challenge of the moment also requires a rebirth of the idea of politics as a vocation, not merely a career or an exercise in self-expression or a method of brand enhancement. The vocation of politics, Max Weber famously wrote in 1919, requires both an ethic of moral conviction and an ethic of responsibility. Put another way, statesmanship requires a firm commitment to certain built-in truths about human beings and their communities, and the skills taught by the virtue of prudence in making those truths live in our common life. So, let us measure ourselves and those who would lead us by those truths and by that virtue. Thank you.